potentially solving a cold case should never be a sad or depressing event.
This is the Veripos 7 True Crime Podcast with your host, Kurt Dillon.
This podcast is like nothing else out there. It's true crime. We don't present that in a morose or moribund manner.
The Veripos 7 features the most interactive and immersive true crime podcasting experience ever imagined.
Our whole goal is engagement with our audience. Before, during, and after each episode, we use actual police documents. This is the only podcast I know of where the audience can actually participate in the verdict.
Don't forget to like and subscribe, so you'll know right away when each new episode goes live.
We are all about solving these crimes. Our whole team is dedicated to uncovering the truth. That's where the name Veritas comes from.
And now, let's get into the action. Take it away, Kurt.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me, your host, Kurt Dillon, tonight for this Veritas 7 episode of The Bizarre Death of Debbie Collier. Debbie Collier's case isn't that old. I don't know if maybe you remember it. It did make national news. She's the 59-year-old woman, mother of two grown children in northern Georgia, who lived in Athens, which is the same town that the Georgia Bulldogs play. In a very bizarre set of circumstances, she wired her daughter just about $2,400 with a very cryptic message that didn't seem to make much sense. And then she pulled off the car on the side of the road and we're led to believe hiked about a mile back up into the woods, where she took off all of her clothes, doused herself with gasoline, set herself on fire, and committed suicide. That's the official story as far as the county sheriff's department goes and as far as the county coroner's office goes in the official autopsy report. That's right. You didn't mishear that. They actually labeled her death a suicide. We're going to get into all of that. We're going to talk about it at length, so you don't want to go anywhere. You definitely want to stay tuned, because Veritas means truth, and the truth starts now.
I can't believe the price of dog food is getting outrageous. And if I want to save a few bucks, I have to carry a 50-pound bag of kibble up the stairs into my apartment. There has to be a better way.
There is. I'm so glad you said something. You poor thing, we've been using TummyTimePetSupplies.com for over a year now.
Tummy Time Pet Supplies? What's that?
TummyTimePetSupplies.com. They have all the major brands and most smaller brands as well. In fact, we not only get all of our dog and cat supplies there, but they also have everything we need for Brett's chinchilla, Ashley's ferrets, Haley's iguana, and even Jordan's pet tarantula.
Wow, they sell all that?
And more. But what's best about TummyTimePetSupplies.com is that they ship everything through Amazon Fulfillment. That means that everything you order gets delivered right to your door, and if you're an Amazon Prime customer, shipping is almost always free.
That really sounds incredible, but I bet it's super expensive. Mark just got laid off and I can't afford all those special conveniences for a while.
Nonsense. In fact, Tummy Time offers some of the most reasonable prices anywhere. You really have to be a whiz and coupon shopping to beat their everyday prices, and when they run sales, forget about it.
I can't believe it, an incredible selection, great prices, and right to your door service. So what do you think?
I think the next time I buy anything for my pets, I'm going to TummyTimePetSupplies.com.
I think that's a very wise choice.
Me too.
That's right. For all your pet needs, it's TummyTimePetSupplies.com. Remember TummyTimePetSupplies.com.
All right, everybody, thank you for joining me today, your host, Kurt Dillon, for this next exciting episode number 3 of the Veritas 7 True Crime Podcast. Today, we are going over the incredibly perplexing case of Debbie Collier, the 59-year-old mother of two in upstate Georgia, in Athens, right where the University of Georgia Bulldogs play, who lives up there, who set about this wild series of events over about a 24-hour window, and then who parked her rental van on the side of a busy road in a paved cutout, walked down a trail into the middle of nowhere by a waterfall, and if you believe the police reports, stripped off most of her clothes, doused herself with gasoline, and set herself on fire after taking an overdose of oxycodone. Oh, and I forgot to introduce, and before she did all of that, she sent a Venmo message to her daughter, wiring her electronically $2,538, along with the very cryptic message, They're not going to let me go. There's a key to the house under the flower pot on the front porch. That's it. And the next time anybody saw or heard from Debbie Collier, she was partially burned, holding on to a small tree stump with her right hand, deceased. So now that we have the macro details of the case, what do you guys think about this?
I think there's absolutely no way someone gets naked and sets himself on fire. Not intentionally, anyways.
I agree. I can't imagine. First of all, if your goal is to set yourself on fire, the clothes are going to help you burn.
She also had this high level of hydrocodone in her, but she had an old back injury, so she had been taking these pills for a long time. So I believe that her dosage limit that she could personally handle was probably pretty significant. So I almost feel like that could be really not even counted in this because she was probably on that level daily.
I agree. I think the oxycodone is like a red herring. It's a coincidence. It just so happens to be there. My take, I don't really think it has anything to do with this. Because if she was that strung out, first of all, she drove 90 minutes away from her home, went to Family Dollar, bought all of these things. And by the way, you folks that are listening to this at home, we have a great video on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheVeritas7. You go to our YouTube channel, we have a great video on there. It was hosted on Court TV of all the footage of her pulling into the Family Dollar, going and buying some very specific items while she was in Family Dollar, and then the next day being dead and burned in the middle of the woods, in the middle of nowhere, Georgia. 90 minutes.
The items that she bought were very strange, too.
Yeah. She bought a tarp, and she bought one of those extended grill lighters that you use to light your grill or your fireplace without burning your hand. And she bought a reusable tote bag.
Yeah, very strange.
All of those items were found burned with her body. Along with that, there was a partially ripped and burned, and this wasn't made public knowledge. I just got this as part of the information that I requested in the FOIA requests. There was a ripped and burned book jacket, which they have not identified the back of the book jacket yet. They found that book jacket. They found a singed piece of paper, and they also found hospital gloves, disposable hospital gloves that were not burned. Blue vinyl nitrile hospital gloves.
So if I'm going in the woods to kill myself, why am I going to have a pair of those gloves with me?
Exactly. And we have those gloves, and they're right there, and they're part of the crime scene, you know, like I said, and the book jacket and the piece of paper and all the things that she just bought.
Are we going to be able to get a hold of the timeline of when she was in the dollar store to the text message that was sent to the daughter and the note that she did text to her son but wasn't sent? Because it would be interesting to know if she bought these items prior to sending these messages to family. So we can kind of get an idea of where her mindset was.
Yes, she did. We have most of the timeline. Obviously, there's no way to know exactly what time she died because she was in the middle of the woods with either by herself, if you listen to the official police report, and then she committed suicide, or with the killer. But other than the people who possibly killed her and herself, there was nobody present when she died. So they only have a rough guesstimate of when she actually died. But the things that she purchased at Family Dollar, the Family Dollar store was about 10 miles away from where she ultimately died. She bought those items the day before her body was found.
But I'd be interested to know the text message she sent her daughter. Was that the day she then died? So she went and bought these items. Then the next day she sent the text and died?
It was around the time that she went to the Family Dollar. Is that
all
when she sent her daughter the Venmo?
Okay, all in that same time frame, the Venmo, the text to the son,
yes,
and Dollar General's.
I don't know how relevant it is, but the text to the son was never actually sent. It was on her phone, but she never actually hit send.
What did that text say again? I forgot.
Just said
the text
I love
to her
you.
Son just said, I love you.
Do we know how far the car was found from her body?
Yes, it was almost a mile up the path. We have crime scene photos of the car, where it was parked, how it was parked, the teddy bear and the flowers that sit there now, where it's at. And we have a whole bunch of crime scene photos of where her body was found in from like every direction.
So the car was a rental. Was it common for her to rent a car?
No, she rented the car because she was in an accident about a month previously. Now, here's another odd spin to this case that some people tried to make an issue of. Those of you who are listening to this also at home, part of the video that we have that's on our YouTube channel is an interview with her son. And in that phone call where he's talking and being interviewed with Court TV's Vinnie Politan, the son, Jeffrey is his name, claims that his mother made an argument that she was afraid of the guy she got into the traffic accident with a month earlier because he had begged her at the time of the accident not to call the police and not to report it because he was on parole and a condition of his parole was he was not allowed to drive. So in other words, if she filed a police report, he was necessarily going to go to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. You're going to go to prison on a parole violation and you're going to do, if you only got a little bit of time left, you're going to do every day of it. If you got 3-5 years yet, you might only do half of that, whatever the case may be, but you're going back to prison. Like I said, do not pass go. Do not collect $200. So in conversation, according to the son, she claimed in conversation with him that she was in fear that he might do something to retaliate because she did contact the police about the traffic act. So that's just an extra little spin. And there's another video that we have on there, which is an interview of Nancy Grace talking about the case. And she is 100% convinced that it was murder. And she's also 100% convinced the idea of a parolee coming back a month later and killing her in the woods is a non sequitur.
Then she knew or had to have some idea that this guy or that she was going to be killed, because the timing of sending the daughter the money and the I love you text to the son right before she dies is a little ironic. Although I have to say I text my children I love you every day and I send my daughter money all the time on Venmo. So, I mean, those things aren't too abnormal. I'm just curious as to the amount that she sent. Was that everything she had in her checking account? Was that a loan her daughter had requested? I mean, there's a lot of unanswered questions there.
Her son did say that Venmo amount was abnormal, that yes. She did typically do Venmo, but it was lower amount.
Right. And there's a couple of odd things with that. First being the amount was $2,385. The message, as I mentioned earlier, was extremely cryptic, especially the first part that says they're not going to let me go. We'll maybe dissect that a little bit here in a couple minutes too. But telling her daughter where the key to the house is in the message, saying they, which is odd, not naming anybody, does kind of lead you to believe that the daughter knows who she's talking about. Otherwise, saying there isn't really going to help you much.
Did you see what the son said about the daughter in that interview?
In that interview, the son doesn't even... I think they had a preconceived notion that they were not going to mention the daughter specifically. Because the son goes out of his way to not mention anything about the daughter.
One of the clips that I had saw, it may not be the one that's on the website, he did bring that up and mention it because I believe someone asked him, and he said that the daughter and the mother had a very close relationship, spoke often, I think even said she was her rock, but he said the sister had some real shady associates, friends, people in her circle that he had a lot of questions about and said were capable of something like this.
And I remember reading something to that effect too. What's also interesting is a report that I read, again, and we're never going to know how true it is because that kind of information is just unobtainable. The report said her boyfriend, Amanda is her daughter's name, Amanda's boyfriend owed back money to probation or parole or something like that. And the amount of money Debbie sent in the Venmo was almost exactly what he owed his back probation. So there is no discussion or mention of whether or not $2,385 completely wiped out her bank account. But that is a really substantial amount of money to send somebody along with a cryptic message like, you know, you're never going to see me again. The wording of that, there's a finality to it. So it's a really odd amount of money. And if it's true, that dollar amount is very close to what the boyfriend owed on his back obligation. That opens up the possibility, in my eyes, of so many other avenues of foul play. I mean, you have...
I agree, and I think the word they is a huge no-brainer, because I believe someone was probably in the car with her. I saw the video of Family Dollar, but you couldn't really see that well when she pulled in, but I believe someone was probably with her and did this and then had to get a ride out. So I think that there was probably two vehicles with two people, and I think the word they tells you that.
Absolutely right. You can see her in the front seat, but that doesn't mean somebody's not sitting in the back seat. I mean, after all, it's a minivan and, you know, they have captain's chairs in the back seat. So you could sit on the passenger side of the back seat. Those windows are very tinted very black in the back of that minivan. So there's no way you're seeing the second or the third row seat. So there very likely could have been somebody in the van. There are other evidentiary pieces, if you look closely, would tend to support your theory, Matt. And I'll tell you what they were, because I thought the same thing. Number one, when you watch that video and you watch her van pulling into the parking lot where the, it's a big shopping center. Family Dollar is only one of the detached stores that's in that shopping center. You can see in the back room, there's a McDonald's. It's a large parking lot that holds probably upwards of 100, 150 cars. There weren't a lot of cars in the parking lot, but there were about 10, 12 that I remember seeing. So you have that. Now, when she first pulls into the parking lot, if you'll notice, if you didn't catch it at first, she pulls in and she parks away from the front of the store. She parks in the second row. That's weird when there are three parking spaces right in front of the store that are empty.
Yep.
Who's going to park and walk, especially on a rainy day? Okay, because it was a rainy day. Who's going to park and walk to go into a store when you can park right in front of the front door? Now, to me, when I first saw that, that screamed. Somebody is afraid that there are cameras pointing at the front of the store, and they think by parking back that the car is not going to be on camera, which was a joke because the cameras catch the whole parking lot.
And she pulled in real slow. It wasn't just pulling into a store to get out of your car and go in. It's just the whole approach was awkward.
And she actually stopped. Now, I don't know if she put the car in park or not, but she actually stopped next to that white car, and she hovered there for a little bit of time. So you have that. Now, when she decides, it's almost like somebody in the back seat is telling her, no, go ahead and pull up to the front. So after sitting there for a minute, she creeps up to the front, and she parks next to that other car, or I'm sorry, where she originally stops is next to that black, like, Escalade. Then she pulls up to the front, and she parks next to that white car, and another silver vehicle, SUV, whatever, comes and parks next to her. She sits in her car for a good minute or two before she gets out, and then the video cuts into her walking into the Family Dollar store. Now, when she walks into the Family Dollar store, obviously she's alone. She's not in there real long. She's in there for, you know, the video doesn't go that long the whole time she was in the store, but I believe they've truncated it, and the officers and the reporters have said she was in the store for like eight and a half minutes. She bought those three items, tarp, one of those like charcoal lighter things that's long, and reusable tote bag, not the one that you're going to, not the little plastic one that you're going to use and throw out. She bought those items. We have her on video checking out, walking out the door, getting back into her car. Now, the video that they provided me so far, that video does not, it cuts out right there. But from what they report, and I'm interested to see this again, from what they report, she sat in the car after she went into Family Dollar and came back out for at least 10 minutes before she put the car in drive and pulled out of the parking lot. Your guess is as good as mine what she was doing. Texting somebody on the phone? Was she talking to somebody on the phone? We just don't know. But
so I'm going to play devil's advocate for just 1 second. Mm-hmm. Matt and I were discussing this case because it's, you can very quickly say who's going to strip their clothes off and burn themselves. You know, who's going to do that right before they decide to take their life? And that's basically what they're ruling this as, a suicide. But in playing devil's advocate on the other side, they are not going to let me go could very well be her talking about the pills and the addiction to the opiates that she was taking. A lot of times addicts refer to whatever it is they're addicted to as kind of its own entity, whether it is the devil that takes over them through drugs or whatever. And anytime you're in rehab, you're encouraged to write a letter to your drug and speak directly to it of, you're not going to have a grip on my life anymore, and so on. So somebody who was struggling with an addiction could very well be referring to they as in, they're not going to let me go, in regards to that she can't win over this addiction any longer. And through the process of withdrawal, it's very common, if you are withdrawing, that your body heats up, and a lot of people during a withdrawal phase will strip their clothing off because they're overheated and get into cold showers. I saw it often when I worked in the emergency room, when we'd have people come in on holds that would just rip their clothes off all the way down to naked because they felt like they were on fire. And
especially opioid
like their body
withdrawal.
Was burning up. Especially opioid withdrawal. That is actually the most common thing that somebody does in withdrawal is to strip their clothing off. It's the first thing that they do because their skin is itchy and on fire and burning. So playing that side of things, a lot of this behavior to me signifies somebody who has reached their end, who doesn't feel they can beat their addiction. Maybe she's sitting in the car writing her goodbye texts to her family and really contemplating that she's purchased these items and constructs that text to her daughter and starts to say it to her son. And that stalled time in the car is just basically coming to terms that she's going to take her life.
I completely see that. Excellent explanation and theory, because that's all absolutely true. The only reason why it doesn't strike me as being what happened here is because, number one, this woman is almost 60 years old. She's 59. She's in very poor health to begin with. She's got a bad back for 20 years. 60-year-old women with bad backs usually don't take hikes in the woods, okay? Especially since there's no evidence that she'd ever been to this place before. So how did she even know that it was there? That's number three. But then if that's true, and if you want to end it and you're at your rope, and there are plenty of people in that scenario that do, when they just feel life isn't worth it anymore, and I've counseled many of them, because part of my practicum to become a psychologist was I had to work for so long as a marriage counselor, and I had to work for so long as a substance abuse counselor. Why would she not just swallow the whole bottle of pills and go to sleep? Why would you, even if you don't want your kids to find you, whatever, okay, take the rental van, go park it out somewhere in a parking lot in a Walmart somewhere, go sit in the back seat in them tinted windows, take that whole bottle of Oxys and just take a nap forever. That just seems to me like so much more of a logical way to end it all than doing the whole thing with going down the trail, buying all these crazy things, sending all these cryptic messages, and setting yourself on fire. Now, that doesn't mean that she couldn't have had a psychotic break, because there are plenty of people that in the throes of their opioid detox have emotional, psychological, and psychiatric collapse as a part of the trip, especially if they weren't mentally sound to begin with, which she wasn't. We found out afterwards that she suffered from chronic depression. We know that. She had depression for years, too.
I think there's another element to support what you're saying. There was an original pathology report, and then the family had a second one done, and they were pretty conflicting. I believe the second one said that in her lungs and her esophagus, there was no smoke and no hot gases, right?
This is where it really starts getting crazy, and it's going to be really interesting. Since the cops have actually declared this a suicide and the case is closed, they're not actually investigating anything, we should be able to have access to all this stuff. So we shouldn't get any fallback on getting the autopsy reports, either the first one or the second one.
But if I remember reading the second one, basically that pathologist said, you know, she wasn't breathing while the fire was going.
That's exactly right. The first autopsy report, which was authored by the medical examiner of that county, who I never heard of and nobody else has ever heard of either, because it's a podunk county in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, the ME and the coroner is probably also the postmaster. His report claimed that her cause of death, and let me see here, I have it. I wrote it down because the verbiage I found to be unique in its own right. The official cause of death was inhalation of superheated gases and thermal injuries, as well as hydrocodone intoxication. That's what her actual autopsy report reads. The first. Now, the interesting thing about that is in order for you to inhale superheated gas, you have to be breathing when the gas hits your face, right?
Correct. Absolutely correct.
Now,
but the second autopsy by a well-known pathologist, I believe, contradicted that, right?
Right. The second autopsy was done at the behest of the son, who paid him out of pocket. It's the very well-known Dr. Michael Bodden, who was the chief pathologist and medical examiner for New York City for 23 or 24 years. He's written 50 books. He's trained hundreds of forensic pathologists, and he's conducted personally, I think they said just under 6,000 autopsies in his career, as well as assisted on probably 2,500 or 3,000 more. So he's seen a lot of dead bodies. And there aren't too many circumstances of death that he hasn't seen. Hideous, horrendous, horrifying, horrific, Frankenstein's monster kind of stuff. He's seen all of that crap. Where the pathologist of Podunk County, Georgia, probably not so much. I can't say that for sure. He could have come from someplace else. The homicide rate in the county where that guy works is not real high. So in his current job, he does not do a lot of autopsies and handle a lot of really strange forensic cases. So not impugning on his reputation, but let's just face it, the other guy, if you were to put both of them on a scale, that scale is going to be awful lopsided as far as their reputations go. Now, when Bodden says that there was no sign of burnt larynx, burnt esophagus, scar tissue, or soot in the throat or in the lungs, well, that's definitive. That's definitive because it tells you that when this body was burnt, she was not breathing. If she was breathing, necessarily, she would have inhaled those superheated gases and that smoke, and her lungs would have exploded from the heat and all kinds of crazy stuff. There was none of that. Her lungs were as pink as a baby's ass, according to what Bodden had to say.
So now we have to assume she got naked, set herself on fire, and then held her breath.
Is it physically possible, like not blinking your eyes, is it physically possible to hold your breath?
I would think once you become unconscious, you're going to start breathing again.
Wasn't this, though, outside in the forest? Or
yes.
So,
in the woods, in the middle of nowhere.
Right. So, like you're saying, would she have that much smoke in her lungs if she wasn't in a confined space? And then my other questions are, and I'm really anxious to get a hold of the police reports on this, is if there was another person involved with this, did they come in a separate vehicle? Were they in her vehicle? Was her vehicle left there and her car was left? And then if that's the case, then how did this person get away if he was possibly with her in the van? Was there foot tracks left behind or other car marks? And what was the ground like on the forest floor? Was it dirt? Was it pine? I want to find out what was left at the scene so that it could explain if there was a second person and how they were able to get away if they did commit this murder out there in the woods.
I didn't see anything about other footprints or tire prints or any other evidence from her rental car. Is that right?
The crime scene, or the spot of the suicide, whichever school you lean toward, was dirt and leaves. It was basically just a typical one open spot in the middle of a densely wooded area. The body was found next to an overturned large tree, very large tree, of which the tree had been overturned for a long time, but part of the root system of the tree was scorched by the fire. Also, somebody had found a... By the way, if you watch the video on our YouTube channel, all of this is in there. So you can watch the actual live video of the cops recording it, the crime scene where the van was, cop cars coming and going, and all that stuff. Somebody took a hatchet or some kind of similar tool and cut down a relatively small tree, which you can see was freshly cut. The top of the tree is there. It's just laying off to the side. And she was holding that base of that tree with her right hand.
But she didn't have anything on her that was capable of cutting that tree, though, right?
Not that anybody recovered. Not that anybody recovered. Nobody recovered an axe or a hatchet or a hacksaw or any of that. And whatever it was, it looked like somebody cut through the tree partway. The tree is in the video. So if you watch the video, you'll see. It looks like somebody cut through three quarters of the tree and then ripped the tree off the rest of the way, or kicked it and broke it off the rest of the way. So it's smooth cut about three quarters of the way through and then rough cut with splinters at the end. So a real weird scene.
Takes me back to my same question is, let's just hypothetically say that there was somebody in the van that's like, okay, drive over here, park here. That person then, after killing her, would have to leave the scene. So, you know, footprints, another second vehicle, tire tracks. I mean, we're talking about a forest. So we've got, like you said, leaves, dirt, pine needles, whatever. There's going to have to be another set of tracks for somebody who's left. Is it just only her footprints that go in? And then what are we seeing in the scene?
Now, the details. The leaves make footprints hard even from the beginning, and it happened right in the middle of autumn, or right at the start of autumn. It was September 11th when her body was found. She disappeared on September the 10th of 22. So the leaves were already changing. The leaves were already falling. Not only that, there were already leaves on the ground from the previous year that never went anywhere because it's the middle of the woods and just nobody goes back there. Where she parked the van was actually paved. It was on the side of a well-traveled state highway that just has a little asphalt, like, parking space.
It's like one little pull-off, just enough.
That's it, just one little pull-off, but it's paved. So 30 people could have been standing there and you never would have seen a footprint because it's on asphalt.
Gotcha.
So the van was there. Obviously, there had to be another vehicle. I would assume that some forensic team from somewhere tore the inside of that van to shreds to try and get a DNA profile from somebody else. But here's the thing. It's a rental van. That's like going into a hotel room and looking for DNA on the bedspread. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're going to find more samples than coded. So it would be real difficult to isolate, even if you did find genetic material in the back of the van, to say that it wasn't just the person that rented the van before her. So, yes, if they were going to do it, if there were other people involved and if there was foul play, they absolutely would have had to bring another vehicle. The only way they found her was that there was a radio frequency ID chip in the van. So eventually the cops tracked the van through satellite, and that brought them to where the van was. When they got to the van and they saw the way it was parked, they brought out the dogs, and it was cadaver dogs that went down into the woods and found the body. And the body was almost a full mile from where the van was. Which, I mean, I'm sorry, if I'm a 60-year-old woman that's overweight, and I have chronic back problems for 20 years, so bad that I've been taking oxys for 2 decades. Imagine tromping through the woods in the rain. Now, she bought a poncho. I'm sorry, that was one of the other things she bought at Family Dollar. She bought a tarp, she bought the tote bag, and she bought the lighter. She also bought a rain poncho.
Well, I saw that, and one of them said it was a poncho, and one of them called it a tarp. And I was thinking that was the same thing.
I believe she bought both. From what I got from the interview with her son and with Politan on Court TV, she bought both of those things.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. When we get the official police reports and all of that, we'll have some of that.
So then somebody had to either put a gun to her and walk her that 1 mile down to this point where she was killed, or she did this on her own willingly. But I mean, I feel like if somebody killed her somewhere else, she would have had to have been drugged down to that location, which if it's a mile from the vehicle, this killer would had to have had some ability to get her to walk all the way down that far.
And to carry her would have definitely been more than one.
Yeah, a mile. They said
part of the police report is that the last, I don't know, 50 feet of the trip, it looked like she fell down the embankment.
So this is going to be really, I think, intriguing to have our listeners really kind of share their thoughts and opinions, because this could go in these two different directions, whether her life was taken by someone or this was a self-inflicted scenario. And I think it's kind of cool to have some of the opinions on one side of, like, I'm convinced this is foul play. And then you can take me, who's out in left field, that's like a devil's advocate, that's like, I can really very well see the scenario of her just wanting to go be one with nature, who's just at this place and is going as far away as possible deep into the forest to just kind of have the moments there, and maybe not even sure how she was going to do it and was just going to stay down there for a few days with the tarp, with the rain and this and that. So I'm still leaning on the other direction, and I think it'll be really cool to hear everybody's opinions on how they think this case is going to go.
Biggest thing that puts me off from the suicide thing is, how did she find that spot? That's what I really want to know. Somebody show me, because when you see the video, you're going to see that all there is roadway. For all you can see in either direction, there's nothing but road. It's one of those rural state highways where you go like 20 miles and all you see is grass and trees.
Right. So you're in a state of hysterics, or you're at your end of your rope and you're crying and you're just driving and you're like, I'm just going to do this. And then you see this little cement turnout in the forest and you pull over and you decide to take your things because you knew you were going to go in the forest somewhere. And this is the spot where you're just going to pull over and go walk into the end of your moments. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say when we hit that place in our lives where we've all had dark moments and where you're driving and you're like, I'm just going to drive this car into a tree, and you just drive and figure out which tree you're going to drive it into. So it's hard to say in that mindset if she was in fact by herself and this was a self-inflicted scenario.
Yeah, you make great points, Ellie. I can't argue with any of that. It makes perfect sense. Yes, absolutely, she could have.
But then all the rest of it makes perfect sense on the other end too. So that's why this is so intriguing.
Exactly. Why the cryptic message with the Venmo? Why wouldn't you tell your kids, you know, I just can't take it anymore. I love you. I'm sorry. Here's all my money. I have to do this. Why would you not try and explain it a little bit to ease their pain? Because you have to know, no matter how mentally off you are, if you have the fortitude to tell your son, I love you, in a text that you never send, and you have the fortitude to send your daughter over $2,500 with a cryptic message about where the key to the house is. I mean, her husband's still living in the house. It doesn't make any sense that she would have to tell her daughter where the key to the house is. And then there's the whole bit about, they're not going to let me go. Demons? Satan? The guardian angel? Who? Who's they?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So those are the questions that I have that aren't really answered by the evidence of suicide. Now, again, listen, if somebody's in the middle of a psychotic break, they're not doing, saying, and acting rationally. So to try and put rational attributes on their behaviors is a fool's errand in and of itself. because, you know, I've had mental illness in my family. When I was like 20 years old, my aunt barricaded herself in her apartment, put tinfoil over the windows, and told me I can't come in because the aliens will suck my brain out of my ear. I lived through that. That's part of the reason what made me want to be a psychologist in the first place. So when people go all out in a mental break, brother, sister, they go all out. I've seen people that are high functioning and they're just a little off, but then I've seen people that go completely off the deep end and there's no rational humanity in them at all. A lot of that is those serial killers and all that other kind of stuff too. Again, I don't know. It would be really interesting. What I didn't see in this, what I would have liked to have seen, I would have liked to have seen the entire history on her cell phone for the 48 hours preceding when they found her body.
For
I would
sure,
like
because
to see
when she's sitting at Family Dollar, if she's not on her phone, she's talking to someone in that car.
Curious to know. Now, another thing that supports suicide, if somebody was taking her there to kill her, she's driving a pretty much a brand new van, a Chrysler Pacifica. They got to know that that van is GPSed every which way to Tuesday. Got a high level. It's not like a cheap ass. That's like the top of the line minivan. It's like it's a $40,000 minivan.
And if there's no one in there and they're following her, how are they going to be like, okay, pull over up there on the right, right? Like, I mean, she has a chance to drive away. So the killer would have to be in the vehicle with her.
Or there had to be more than one killer, one driving in a chase vehicle and the other one riding with her.
In the vehicle with her.
But now here's the funny thing. If you're under duress, why would she not tell the lady in Family Dollar? Why would she not? You know what I mean? She was by herself.
I considered that. But what I think probably to answer that particular question, the daughter's boyfriend could have easily told her, look, if you do anything, the daughter's bye-bye.
Absolutely.
So I believe that was probably, if the way I kind of think it happened, that was his tool to control her.
Oh, absolutely. And that's 100%. And honestly, that's the way I lean. That's just me. It's my opinion. It's not whatever. But there's just too much coincidence. And the only explanation for clearance that we got from the law enforcement is they checked the cell phone records and what towers the daughter and the boyfriend's cell phones were pinging off of for like that 2-day window. And there's no evidence that either one of them went to that area.
Well, then did any money go to the boyfriend from that money that she sent her daughter? Did you know, was his debt paid? I mean, did the daughter then Venmo him or pay whatever his probation violation was or whatever it was that he owed?
Now, here's the funny thing with the money. The money was immediately seized by the police. It was only just recently returned to her. So I don't know what she did with it now, but for most of the time after it was after the money was sent and her body was found, the police seized that money. So she didn't get it.
Do we know what he did to be on probation?
No idea. Haven't seen that in any of the records. And quite honestly, privacy laws are probably going to prevent us from knowing unless he's officially named the suspect and the police, you know, decide to disseminate that information. If it turns out he's on probation for setting somebody on fire in the woods, you know what I mean? That's going to pique somebody's curiosity, but I'm thinking he's probably drug related.
So the tote bag that she purchased was probably used to carry all of the items that she was buying in to take on that walk or hike with her. And then did they say what the fuel source was?
It was a gas can.
Gas can. Yeah. And then she purchased that obviously somewhere else.
There was no receipt for the gas can. There was just a gas can that she brought with her.
I think they found part of it melted nearby, right?
Yeah. It would be interesting to know if the husband could identify the gas can as being one that they own, since there's no evidence that she just recently bought it. Really be good to know. It would also be good to know if they had those blue vinyl nitrile gloves at the house, if there's no evidence that she bought surgical gloves, match that book jacket to a book that she actually owned or possessed.
Are the sister and the boyfriend still together?
Good question. I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence on that one way or another. But now, here's what's really odd. The daughter, Amanda, is out doing the podcast circuit. If you Google Amanda's name, put like 20 podcasts that she's on. She's pulling her eyes out in every one of them.
That's interesting. Well, this will be a good one for our listeners, for all of you guys to share your research on this case, because again, we're at a standstill on enough evidence to be able to come up with an exact outcome at this point.
And just as a last and final two caveats, in the video that we have on the website, one of the first things that you'll see in like the first 30 seconds or minute of the video is a deputy from the sheriff's office there where they found the body saying, and I quote, at this point, We have absolutely no evidence that leads us to believe there was a kidnapping or a suicide involved here. That's the very first part of that video. Second, towards the end, you'll see that the son, Jeffrey, actually has a lawsuit now pending and formal complaints against the chief of police because apparently at one point when he was talking about the evidence, he smirked and laughed about it. And there was a series of leaks inside the department where media sources knew about facts of the case and evidence in the case before the family was told. One of those, I believe, was that the body was recovered and where it was. So I believe that the media released that they had found the body and where it was before the family was ever notified that they found the body. So Jeffrey is now suing the pants off of that county sheriff, but he definitely tells you about it in the video.
Well, this will be an interesting topic of conversation when we get our listeners involved in this, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Can't wait. Absolutely can't wait to hear their feedback, their talking points, whether they lean towards suicide. We're definitely, as part of our online thing, we're going to poll our listeners on what they think and how they feel about the different aspects of these cases. So definitely, like I had mentioned before, you want to go to visit our website at www.veritas7.com. Join our discussion group on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/TheVeritas7. So definitely go and do that. Join the conversation. We can discuss these things at any time. Our staff will be happy to engage with you in these conversations, and our other listeners will be happy to engage with you in this discussion group on your own, even if one of us doesn't happen to be there right at that moment. So you definitely want to talk about these and what evidence and scenarios you might happen to hear or come about.
I'm looking forward to hearing what everyone has to say.
Yeah, me too.
I can't believe the price of dog food is getting outrageous. And if I want to save a few bucks, I have to carry a 50-pound bag of kibble up the stairs into my apartment. There has to be a better way.
There is. I'm so glad you said something. You poor thing, we've been using TummyTimePetSupplies.com for over a year now.
Tummy Time Pet Supplies? What's that?
TummyTimePetSupplies.com. They have all the major brands and most smaller brands as well. In fact, we not only get all of our dog and cat supplies there, but they also have everything we need for Brett's chinchilla, Ashley's ferrets, Haley's iguana, and even Jordan's pet tarantula.
Wow, they sell all that?
And more. But what's best about TummyTimePetSupplies.com is that they ship everything through Amazon Fulfillment. That means that everything you order gets delivered right to your door, and if you're an Amazon Prime customer, shipping is almost always free.
That really sounds incredible, but I bet it's super expensive. Mark just got laid off and I can't afford all those special conveniences for a while. Nonsense. In fact, Tummy Time offers some of the most reasonable prices anywhere. You really have to be a whiz and coupon shopping to beat their everyday prices, and when they run sales, forget about it.
I can't believe it, an incredible selection, great prices, and right to your door service. So what do you think?
I think the next time I buy anything for my pets, I'm going to TummyTimePetSupplies.com.
I think that's a very wise choice.
Me too.
That's right. For all your pet needs, it's TummyTimePetSupplies.com. Remember TummyTimePetSupplies.com.
All right, everybody, as usual, thank you again for joining us. We're really happy to have you here
for this, the third episode of the Veritas 7 True Crime Podcast. For all of us here at the Veritas 7, have a great night. Take care. Stay safe. God bless. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Hard and let you know that I am near. The sun is setting fast, I know, and I can feel you bid me go, but I don't wanna leave just yet. 'Cause I've got so much left to see, but I know freedom ain't that free if I ain't got you by my side. Oh, my love, won't you come and walk with me a while? Time don't stop, even in the middle of a dream. So turn the car around and leave. Meet me underneath the tree, inside the valley that we made. And with our hands we'll make the best of the life that we have left.
Turn the car around and leave. Meet me underneath the tree inside the valley that we made. And with our hands we'll make the best of the life that we have left. And we will never say goodbye. And if we do, we'll meet again. Knowing love was heaven sent, and I've never felt this way.